because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless
you. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And this is Rewind, Wisconsin Eye's summary of this week in the Capitol. It was a busy week, J.R., but Tuesday there was an election.
Yes.
Justice Ann Walsh Bradley won her third 10-year term on the court. Let me check the numbers. She got 58%. Did that margin surprise you?
Not in some ways, because there wasn't any kind of counter, if you will, to the Bradley message on TV or the Greater Wisconsin message on TV.
Did Daly run TV ads?
Not that I found. He did some a lot of radio, but there wasn't any TV up. So in some ways, she was unanswered, if you will. And you can kind of tell what was surprising, though, is like if you look at Brown County, which is to win statewide as a conservative in Wisconsin, you have to do well in Brown County. You have to run the number up there, actually. She won 58% of the vote in Brown County. That is not a good sign if you're a Republican running state or a conservative running statewide. So things like that, yeah, she did very well up north, which, you know, she's from Wausau area, so
yeah,
that kind of makes sense. But
former Marathon County judge.
Other than like the ring counties around Milwaukee, he didn't do well.
But Daly, when he conceded, he said, "I lost to the power of the incumbency." Is that right? Or is it just a candidate who thrashed about for issues and didn't find any winning issues?
Well, he didn't find winning issues. He also didn't raise a lot of money.
Right.
Didn't get any outside help. And let's be honest, if you are a conservative running in Wisconsin for state Supreme Court, outside groups are your saving grace. I mean, he actually got a recording of an event that he did to a Republican group a few months ago, which his aide said that. They're our saving grace. Outside groups come in and help us. You know, that's they're not coordinating with them, but they know that that's what you need. You need to have that big firepower, WMC, the outside groups. They do lots of ads. They're very successful in defining Joanne Kloppenburg, Linda Clifford, go back a few years.
Sure.
Louis Butler, Loophole Louie, that was a WMC ad. Very effective, spend a lot of money, and it helps her candidates. He didn't get that help this time.
And he only had like 18% of the voters turn out, right, JR?
Yeah, roughly, right on the 19th, pretty close. I mean, it's a spring election. You're not going to get a whole lot. There wasn't a lot of like big ticket races on the ballot. Madison Mayer was one. Wasn't anything in Milwaukee that was really countywide. A lot of school referendums, but nothing that really like inspired a huge swell. But if you look back historically, last 10 years, other than the Kloppenburg-Prosser election 11, which was a proxy fight based about a referendum on Act 10, if you will. It was 34% that year. It's been 18-19% every spring because they're just not there's not enough to pull people out to these races.
And as you say, WMC didn't run ads for Daly, but they ran ads for that constitutional change, which is the second issue. Voters voted to change the Constitution. For 126 years, the longest-serving justice has been the Chief Justice. As a result of the amendment, which was approved 53-47, the Chief Justice will be chosen by the total seven justices. What struck you about the fact that this got 53% when Bradley got 58?
The only theory I'd heard about how the amendment might fail is if she ran up a big score and people turn out for her would also vote against the amendment.
Yeah.
But it didn't really, wasn't a connection.
Right.
I mean, honestly, if you look at, even though the pro-amendment forces spent more money than the anti-amendment forces on TV and radio, let's be honest, it ran the week of spring break, a lot of places, the week before Easter. I watch a little bit of TV, not a whole lot. I didn't see a single ad when I was watching. Now, I wasn't watching the news much last week, but it wasn't like it was blanketing the airwaves. There wasn't a high voter awareness of this issue. My guess in talking to other people is that the average voter went in the booth and said, okay, this says they vote for the Chief Justice. Well, that makes sense. Now, what's fascinating,
kind of
though,
vote with a shrug. Go ahead.
It's that got more votes overall than the Supreme Court race did. So even though that was the top of the ticket, was Supreme Court, and that was like the last question asked, it got more votes.
It was the last question. I was surprised to find that way down on my ballot.
So why that happened, I have no idea. I haven't found anybody's got a good theory yet about that.
What about your WMC? Did WMC's 600,000 make the difference and pass this constitutional amendment? That's a very simplistic theory.
Yeah, I got the impression there was it was favored to pass anyway because it was simply worded. It seemed to be like a no-brainer in terms of the public of, well, they vote for it, so why wouldn't you? Now, the anti-amendment forces did not do a very good job of connecting it to Shirley Abramson, of saying this is an unfair thing in their minds to go after the Chief Justice, though she's had the job for 20 years, they're targeting her. I mean, they tried, but it was very late, it was very small. You know, there was an avenue there to try and make that connection, but it wasn't, they weren't able to. Maybe it was resources, maybe it was time, but again, you're talking the week before of spring break, people aren't really tuned into TV that much. So.
That's right. That's right. But which led within 24 hours of that vote, I think it's a top story of the week. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it coming. Did you see it coming? Chief Justice sued to keep the Chief Justice job through the end of her term in 2019.
And sued in federal court.
Mm-hmm. Did you see that one coming, my friend?
No. Interesting note, Shirley Abramson actually signed the complaint on Monday before people went to the polls. She was got ready just in case, apparently.
Oh, you're a good reporter. I noticed that she signed it. She signed it Monday?
Yes. So, you know, maybe just being prepared just in case. But what's interesting is, one, let's be honest, the Republicans have said for a long time, this is not about Shirley Abramson, all right? This is about democracy in the court. Mm-hmm. They couldn't beat her the ballot box. This is a way to get her off Chief Justice role. Mm-hmm. Now, you can make the argument what she's part of the dysfunction. She doesn't deserve to have that role because there is a conservative majority in the court right now. She is in the minority. The people who are...
And she's also had such a heavy hand that she's resented by the
you
other justices.
You make all these arguments, let's be honest. It has always been about dislodging Shirley Abramson from that office.
I couldn't agree more.
You know, so there's that. So there was real politics involved in this. Now, this lawsuit, I'm not a lawyer. I have no idea if there's a chance of this passing. I mean, I got to be honest, or of it being successful. There is a question, though, what kind of PR hit will she take? I mean, you know, she's been Chief Justice for a long time. I mean, it will not diminish her distinguished career of 30-plus years on the bench, 40 years on the bench, whatever it is at this point. Right. She is a brilliant legal mind. She's got all kinds of accolades. That won't go away. But it might be a little bit of a sour note, if you will, to end her career. She's got 4 years left on the bench. The implication from reading that lawsuit is she's not going to run again in 2019. So it may be a sour ending, if you will, in some ways.
It's pretty interesting. You and I read the 22-page lawsuit. I just want to read one sentence. Any change would violate the federal due process rights of Chief Justice Abramson to continue to serve as Chief Justice during the remainder of her elected term. She's elected in 2009, so that runs through 2019. Despite incurring no other disability that would render her ineligible to serve in that office. So she's saying, I was elected as the Chief Justice, and she also makes what I think is a fascinating, you're taking away my property argument.
Yeah.
If I lose this job, I'm going to lose the $8,000 additional dollars. The other six Supreme Court justices make $147,000. She makes $155,000.
Yes.
So she's arguing that due process rights, that she's having property taken away, which I just find amazing.
I have no idea, again, if that is a valid legal argument, but it is fascinating to say an elected official has a property right. Is there a job? Now, if you extrapolate it out to lawmakers, you can't change their salaries up or down during the course of their term.
Right.
That's a bit different situation, but it is kind of an interesting
And the
argument.
Supreme Court has held that pension rights, once they're bestowed, amount to property rights that amount to takings, So now we have the Supreme Court Chief Justice turning to a federal judge, suing her fellow six justices. This is just amazing. And WisPolitics, you guys also reported on some of the campaign contributions. Justice Abramson's husband wrote $10,000 to help Ann Walsh Bradley.
Yes, Justice Prosser gave $500, personal contribution to Daley in the final days of the campaign.
And Justice Rogenczak, was it her or her spouse?
Husband.
Her husband.
Yeah. And I mean, there are two factions on that court. There are no two ways about it. There's Shirley and Ann Walsh Bradley, and then Justice Crook sometimes sides with them. Then there's a solid, most of the time, four seats of Gableman, Ziegler, Rogenczak, and Prosser. And Prosser, obviously, he had a physical altercation with Ann Walsh Bradley a few years ago.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, she says he tried to choke her. He says she charged me. I tried to defend myself. But
you have that unresolved ethics complaint filed against him as a result of that.
But the Prosser donation adds some spice, if you will, to that. That's unusual to see a justice. I mean, now, we've seen races before. Justices have weighed in for the other person. I mean, go back when Shirley ran in 1999, which is before my time, but several justices actually endorsed her opponent,
yes,
which is a real rarity, and were very publicly against her.
Yes.
You know, so there's been some tension in that court for a long time. It isn't as bad as it was 4 years ago, it seems like, but still there's a lot of tension in that
court.
But
this week we had a new historical, tragic definition of collegiality, the Chief Justice suing her fellow six justices.
And that goes back to the reputation thing. Will it be a sour ending, if you will, for her career, or does it give more fodder, if you will, to conservatives say, look, the problem isn't Prosser or whoever. It's Shirley is the one driving a lot of this stuff. I mean, it gives them fuel for that fire to make that argument.
And I asked yesterday of Shirley's office, and she says taxpayers are not paying for this lawsuit, which was filed by a Washington, D.C. law firm. But yesterday, she wanted a restraining order. The other six justices couldn't. Remember, Rogan's Act told the Associated Press, we're going to meet pretty soon to resolve this. And Chief Justice Abramson asked for a restraining order. A judge yesterday said, no, you don't get a restraining order. It's premature. I intend to resolve this quickly. Now, GAB certifies the election results April 29th. So it's just fascinating. Anybody that you've talked to say that this case, just on a pure legal basis, has merits, or is it a crapshoot?
It's a crapshoot. It is a novel argument. I've seen a couple of conservative legal commentators this morning saying that they've never seen an elected official claim a property right to their position, if you will. But, you know, I don't know. I haven't done a case law search to know for sure. But it seems like, plus to your talk going to federal court about a state issue, it could be a stretch. We'll see.
Okay. Next topic.
Here's the caveat.
Go.
She is a brilliant legal mind.
Yes. Okay. Now, next one. I'm going to put on shades because the Milwaukee Bucks announced this gleaming $500 million new arena, and they say it'll trigger economic development worth $500 million more. And boy, the architects, I mean, it hurts my eyes. That's why I'm wearing the shades. Does this strike you as a starter that's going to be part of the budget deal? Okay, I can remove the cheaters now. Go ahead.
It adds a little fuel, a little movement, if you will, in the Bucks' favor. The issue is it doesn't resolve, well, who's going to pay for it and how much? And how much local is going to chip in. So they're also a little bit light on details, if you will. I mean, they showed us a picture of the arena. They showed us $500 million. But what about beyond that? You know, how is this going to work? There's still a little bit of hesitancy of Republicans I talked to of, they still want us to pay a lot of money for this arena, and I'm not sure what we're getting out of it. And, oh, by the way, the locals, they're really going to benefit now because it's not just an arena. They're getting extra $500 million in investment around the arena.
Housing, retail, entertainment complex around there.
Mayor Barrett, this is more even bigger benefit for you than was before. So why aren't you ponying up more money for the project?
Right. But you and I listened in to the meeting of the Board of Commissioners of the Public Lands, and they're sitting on about $1 billion in assets. And we heard the Executive Director, Tia Nelson, say, we've got about $50 million that we could chip in pretty easily. Mm-hmm. But if Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald, if you want an additional $100 million, that would take some type of a more complex sale or bonding?
So of the $1 billion, they have $100 million in cash. They want to have. They recommend $50 million be kept back as a reserve, if you will, just in case, because they do loans for local governments. There's about $500 million in loans currently, and or $400 million bonds, or vice versa, one of the two. So they could sell bonds to then help finance this arena.
Yes.
Here's the issue. Both Doug LaFollit and Matt Adamczyk both said, look, you know, we're open to helping, but we're not going to sell a bond that's getting 3% right now and give it to you at 2.5. That makes no sense because the interest off these loans goes to public school libraries.
Schools and libraries.
So we're not going to shortchange kids just to help fund a professional athletic arena.
Okay.
So how's that going to work? This other issue is, I'm no bond sale expert, but if you flood the market with a bunch of bond sales at one time, you can call it a ripple effect. Tia raised the point during the meeting. She had talked with the governor's staff that day and said, it is possible that the Bucks owners who are hedge fund managers could participate in a private bond sale to try and create a little certainty and be part of this process.
Right.
So that's not saying it will happen, but that's one possible issue raised. So one thing to watch too.
And I worked history here. There was a precedent. Mm-hmm. In 1967, the Board of Commissioners of Public Land loaned $67 million to help remodel Lambeau Field, and Tia Nelson scores that as it returned $11 million in interest. Now, you and I heard Attorney General Schimmel say, yes, but we're talking maybe almost 2.5 times that. The immediate response, Governor Walker and Assembly Speaker Voss said, city and county, you got to pony up. Mm-hmm. You got to ante up more money. Do you think they will?
City keeps saying that we are going to commit to this governor's original plan of $50 million in the city and county, and our share is going to be infrastructure improvements and a parking garage that's near the current arena downtown. I don't know that that's made Robin Voss happy, if you will, or Scott Fitzgerald. Speaking with Voss yesterday after some of the rules committee, I asked him, because it's been pointed out to me that there are ways to compel the city to do more.
Yeah.
Is that a possibility? Well, yes, but we don't get to that point. I'm very optimistic, he said, we'll reach a good deal. Well, what's that deal going to look like, and what do they have to do with the city to get them on board? The county's been more quiet about what it's working on. We've been told Chris Abele is working on some kind of option, his own option, if you will. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen that yet. But it's clear that the city is trying to dig in, saying this is what we're going to do, and that's not it. We're not going to property tax this project.
Okay, but we have moved off Walker's February 3rd offer of the jock tax, haven't we?
Yes.
And so things seemed generally to be, you and I reading tea leaves, but they seem to be a little bit closer to some type of a deal.
They are moving closer. It's how can they get everybody on board, and can they get more out of the locals? That's, I think, is a real hang-up. Now, when you talk to Republicans, they keep saying, this is even a bigger pressure for the city to do more because they're going to have a huge, huge development, breathe new life in this downtown area. Why aren't they paying more money? And Barrett keeps saying, we're not going to put property taxes into this. We're not going to do that. And lawmakers go back, well, didn't you just do a trolley? You know, that their words.
Yeah.
The trolley to nowhere, they call it.
Right.
If you can find money for that, why can't you find it? It's this back and forth. It's the same story.
Yeah.
Talked about for a month, 2 months now of the Republican position versus the Mayor Barrett position.
Well, I did an interview last week with State Representative Mary Chaya, who's on the Finance Committee, but comes from a very rural area. And she walked me through, number one, she thinks her constituents don't support it, but once she walks them through the money, saying, you know, we have some, we're obligated here for the Bradley Center, so we're on the hook for big bucks. So she seemed to be indicating that she could support it. There's an outstate repub.
And that's one thing that they should have sold better, if you will, is the hook that we have, the $100 million we're on the hook for.
Mm-hmm.
The governor's tried to talk that up, but I'm not sure that's quite resonated yet with lawmakers. They go, okay, yeah, you know, I'm worried about that, if you will.
Yeah.
They want to see more out of the owners or the city and county or both before they really kind of commit to it.
Okay, next subject. As we meet, the Board of Regents is approving pretty hefty tuition increases on non-residents, mm-hmm. internationals, grad students, and specialized schools. The UW-Madison increase, my sources at Journal Sentinel, from 9% to 20%. The biggest hit, non-resident student in the vet medicine school, 20% upper. Non-resident undergraduate increase, 11.7%. And the regents say, look, if the governor's budget is going to hit us, mm-hmm. $300 million over two, cut our aid. We need to do this. But immediately, Senator Nass said, Chancellor Blank of the UW has abandoned the middle class.
Sticking to him, yeah.
Do you look for these tuition increases, which will be approved and recommended by the regents, are they going to cause flags in the Capitol among the legis? Are the legis going to say, okay, we understand if we're going to cut your state aid up to $300 million, you've got to enact these tuition increases?
One point that was raised while President Cross testified at joint finance was, well, you can raise tuition, can't you, to help make up some of this on non-residents. I think the non-resident undergrad tuition will be $35,000 a year when this is all said and done.
Thank you, JR. It's going to increase more than 35%. It's going to go from 25,523 in the next year to 35,523. That's a 35% increase by 2019.
Yes, which was more than my four-year education cost 20 years ago.
Yeah. That's, well, you got two sons. You better hope they charge you dad
or we don't
resident tuition.
Or we don't move out of state. But here's the thing. There is a rub, though, that you've had this tension with lawmakers for a long time of there are too many out-of-state kids at UW-Madison. It's our flagship campus, and my district kid can't get in because he's got a 3.2 and all this stuff, and they're getting shut out by Illinois kids. Well,
They pay higher freight, excuse me.
Yeah, so there's been this tension of, well, yeah, but we need these kids because they pay more. They help subsidize the cost of in-state, so it goes back and forth, and it has for a long time. So the universities are saying, look, this is the option you gave us. We're going to take advantage of it to do this. By the way, your local kid in your district with the 3.2 or whatever, who, if he does get in, he's going to keep paying a flat tuition rate for the next 2 years because of what's going on. So they're trying to keep the in-state kids held harmless, if you will, by sticking the other.
And I was struck yesterday. Assistant President Ray Cross continues to fan the flames and argue for the autonomy plan in the governor's budget. That's dead, yep. Isn't it?
No, they're not going.
No, it's not dead. Or yes,
they're not going to even complete autonomy. No, there's no way to do that.
Right.
But they are going to give them some kind of flexibilities. What they're going to be, I don't know yet. But the problem for Republicans is they're going, look, you're not talking about tenure. You're not talking about class load. You're not talking about shared governance. We want those things to go away. The university is saying those are things that make us unique, mm-hmm. and that we want to preserve for our relationship with our professors.
Academic freedom.
And oh, by the way, a lot of this is about Madison. Madison is unique of those campuses. They're saying, look, if you take those away, our top flight professors at Madison will go somewhere else where they do have tenure and these other protections that we don't want to give them up. We want to keep it a true flagship campus that has a, something special to it. And so it's you know, it's a little tension right now.
It's very interesting. And now some of the 26 schools in the UW system are starting to list, they're offering buyouts, mm-hmm. and they're targeting specific programs that would be cut. You'll no longer be a men's tennis team at UW Oshkosh, for example. So this is just a really interesting issue. Okay, weekly update. How's the Walker for President campaign beat?
Kind of quiet. He was in the state this week, so there wasn't as much kind of consternation, if you will, or like stories about what he did or didn't say. It was kind of actually quiet this week for Governor Walker. A couple polls done by Quinnipiac yesterday that were out yesterday had him doing okay against Hillary Clinton, but that was more a function of Hillary Clinton's had a little bit of rough spell, if you will, last few weeks than anything else. He is now in a couple hours speaking for the NRA's annual convention in Nashville. He heads from there to a trade mission to France, Germany, and Spain.
Yes.
Then comes back from that. He'll be in New Hampshire next weekend for another speech to party activists. So he was in the state this week, though, so there wasn't as much national tension, if you will, in the governor.
Yeah, but what about President Obama mentioned his name, took him to school, spanked him.
I can't forget that.
I understand, but there are some people who say when the president names you, it gives you credibility as a presidential candidate, even though President Obama said Scott Walker should go to school in foreign policy.
It's golden advertising for Walker. I mean, if you think about it, the base, Republican base does not like President Obama at all.
Right.
So if President Obama is saying, you're a bum, they're going, this guy is my kind of guy. So it's like, they love it. They're saying, hey, President Obama, please pick on us constantly.
And for that, for just every reason, are you surprised that President Obama used the name Scott Walker and said he ought to go to school in foreign policy?
Good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't pretend to know what the president is thinking, but you are basically feeding the fire for this guy of he's a real contender, legitimizes him, and people in base go, yeah, this guy is, you know, and Walker fired back. You know, he fired back at the president this week and is not going to just let that opportunity go by and not get a jab in, if you will, and go toe-to-toe with him.
Yeah, he put both fingers in the president's
side.
Please
say more about me, President Obama.
Please. Well, okay, but Ted Cruz is in. Mm-hmm. And Rand Paul is in, and Hillary's going to get in soon.
Sunday. Yeah.
When do you hear is Governor Walker's timetable?
The timetable has been get the budget done and do it this summer. Now, there was at one point some thought of, oh, this is such a rocket ship all of a sudden for his candidacy that he's got to get in soon. But there's no rush. I mean, there's a complaint file about he's really a candidate already kind of thing. But he's funding his trips through as a political organization. There is no need for him to start raising money according to the federal restrictions on donations. He's got time. It's not like Governor Walker's walking around and like isn't getting attention because he hasn't declared for presidency. He is getting plenty of attention. Why change the dynamic right now?
The NRA to Europe to New Hampshire in the next weekend.
And beyond.
My goodness. Okay, time for Wispolitics stock report rising.
Paul Farrell, then he wins the county
executive
race.
State Senator Paul Farrell.
Won the county executive race in Waukesha County. What's interesting is the Walker model, he went from the state assembly the county executive in Milwaukee to statewide office. There's an opportunity, if you will, for Paul Farrell to go from state legislature, county exec, statewide. Now, one of the differences is Governor Walker had, as then county executive Walker, the county board to be his foil, you know, to have these big dramatic fights to play out and talk radio and build his credentials, if you will. Paul Farrell's not going to have nearly as many fights with the county board in Waukesha County as Walker did with the Milwaukee County Board. So there's that. But it still is right in the heart of talk radio country. It is going to give him, you know, a little bit of platform and make him parlay it into, you know, some decent numbers.
It's also interesting. He's not going to formally resign from the Senate until June after he votes on the 2015-2017 budget.
Budget's done. Governor's doing any vetoes. They have to do any reviews. So, you know,
is he open to the charge he's double dipping then as county exec and state senator?
I don't know if he's decided what he knew the salary and those kinds of things or how to, like, to push back. He doesn't take office for another week or two weeks, I think it is.
Yeah, I think so.
So a little bit of time with that. Another good thing about this or interesting about this race is him leaving creates a domino effect, where now you have Chris Cappinga announced this week, state lawmaker, ran the primary for that seat against Farrell in 2012 and lost. He's already in. I mean, we knew that months ago.
There's
going to
be other candidates. There'll be a primary.
Back in December, Cappinga transferred 75, or loaned his campaign $75,000, fresh off of winning like with 67% of the vote in his election, that he's going to run. Brian Doro, who is the associate dean in criminal justice over at Washington Technical College, he's making moves to run. Others might kick the tires, if you will. I mean, if you think about it, like if you're Adam Nalen, who elected in a special election in 13 for assembly seat in that district, it's a free shot. You know, it's going to happen in September-ish probably. So you could run, see how you do, and if you lose, so what? So at your assembly seat.
I want to circle back to something you said, the Walker pattern, state assembly, county exec to governor. Do you think Paul Farrell wants to be considered? Do you think he'd like to be governor? Is he open to it?
I think a lot of people like to be considered for governor. I mean, if you think about it, the betting money in Madison is that Governor Walker, whatever happens in 16, is not going to run again in 18.
Right.
So who's going to run? I mean, you hear
the speaker, lieutenant governor, for sure.
Speaker Voss.
Potentially.
There's a wide open field, though. It could be an interesting race. And if you're county exec and you've got good numbers in one of the most populous Republican counties in the state
that has
a big bunch of voters right there,
okay,
it's not a bad place to be. Now, what happens? Is it President Walker after 16 and Governor Clayfish? Does she have a primary shot? I mean, there are all kinds of like these what-if scenarios that until we know what happens with 16 and Governor Walker, who knows for sure. And
but
Mark Pocan this week, one of our luncheons, says, oh, Walker's going to take off after 16 no matter what.
He told that to us, too. Yeah. It's so interesting. But the point is, the takeaway here, you have got Farrell rising in your stock report because he's in a pretty good position.
Yeah,
having served in the Senate, now serving in probably the most GOP county.
One of them, Ozaukee in Washington, right next door.
Yeah. And all these options ahead of him.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Okay, mixed.
The Bucks.
Oh, I'll reach for my... go ahead.
Here's one thing about the Board of Commissioner of Public Lands money. It's been a hard sellout state to Republicans to say, okay, look, what benefit do I get by approving the state money for a Milwaukee arena for a NBA team owned by billionaires? One argument you can make, though, by borrowing money from the BCPL is it's bucks for books. That because the interest on those bonds goes back into school libraries, you actually do get a benefit to your district back home. Your kids are going to see more library materials, those kind of. Now, not saying it's going to be a great selling point, but you have at least one avenue of that, plus marry it with, look, if we don't do anything, we're on the hook for $100 million, that we take that $100 million away from, you know, your schools, your Medicaid, everything else. So there's a little more of a selling point, but again, it's that they need more. Republicans need more before they're on board with the whole thing.
Bucks for books. I see a bumper sticker coming. Is that you or somebody else using that?
That was somebody else's line.
Somebody else's line. That's a good one. Falling.
James Daly, you know, we were just talking about how, as a conservative, you need the outside groups to help you, right?
Yes.
James Daly made a very blunt pitch to Republicans and conservatives, kind of like, I need your help. But by doing that, he opened himself up to this attack from Ambrose Bradley of, this guy's a partisan. He's going to inject partisan politics into a nonpartisan court. And let's be honest. We all know these guys are not non-ideological. All justices have a bent one way or another.
Yes, they do.
But Bradley was able to hold himself up as, I'm above that partisan fray. I'm going to be a justice who gives a fair shake to everybody in our TV ads. This guy is going to be rubber stamped for Governor Walker's agenda. That's inappropriate. I got the impression from some folks this week that even voters who may not be offended by voter ID or by Act 10, who think those are good things, are going, you know, I don't want somebody on the court who's making a naked pitch about those things.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of hurt him a little bit. Struggled off the ground, never raised a lot of money. It wasn't the best campaign. I know, by the way, we talked last week about the line in the debate of, coordination is illegal in all cases. Well, if you're WMC and these groups saying, this is not the kind of guy we want on the court,
right,
even if they were inclined to try and go after Ambrose Bradley, he kind of snuffed out any hope there was. I don't think there was much hope. They snuffed it out, that debate.
Fine. Yeah, I agree. Okay, I'm going to close on this note. I want to note the passing of Mark Murata. Mm-hmm. Let's look at his achievements. You know, Marquette basketball captain, three-time academic All-American, drafted by the NBA but opted for Harvard Law School, Governor Doyle's Department of Administration secretary, partner Foley and Lardner, and on the day that the Bucks announced the new arena proposal, he's chairman of the BMO Harris Bradley Center, a key part of that. We both covered Mark Murata. I appreciated his ability to laugh at all things. You know, he didn't take himself too seriously, didn't take politics too seriously. And you and I have heard his name over the last 10 years as a potential candidate for something.
Oh, yeah.
So any memories of Murata?
The most vivid one, actually, is for a while when he was DOS secretary, I was living in Milwaukee and driving back for the Madison every day. I'd pass him on 94 in his BMW talking on his phone.
Yeah.
Just kind of look over and, you know, he wasn't paying attention to me. But, I mean, I think he was well-respected by people. And I can picture him testifying in front of Joint Finance and just not taking the grilling too seriously and not being overly upset, if you will, at the questions being. I mean, he's overall a well-respected man.
And just a P.S. on that, if you look at, I've been following Russ Feingold's Facebook and Twitter posts, mm-hmm. and he's been going around the state. And March 12th, he had lunch with Mark Murata, and you and I know what that's about. Mm-hmm. Mark, what role will you play when I formally announce to try to get back my U.S. Senate seat? So Mark Murata was still a player in Wisconsin, and he had a lot of achievements. So just on that note, I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And that's Rewind for April the 10th.